So the topic for today's sessions are identity in vocation and creation, or identity in creation and vocation. Yes, you have to come all the way down to the front now. It's just so sad, isn't it? Who are we? Identity in creation and vocation. And when we ask the question, who are we? I'll say in a few moments a few parameters within which the current world system defines our identity. But within the scriptures, within the framework of the Bible, you can't ask the question, who are we, without also at the same time asking, whose are we? Who are we is defined by who we belong to. Now, we find that in a number of places in the scriptures. Sometimes you come to those long bibliographies, not bibliographies, genealogies in the scriptures. And if you're ever rostered to do the Bible readings on Sunday, you hope you're not going to get one of those. And sometimes we wonder, what is that there for? It seems so pointless from our point of view, because we're interested in a cracking narrative and we want the story to move on, and then in the middle of it you get this great list of names, and so-and-so was the son of so-and-so, and this is how long he lived. And the point of all of that in the scriptures was that you didn't know who you were as an individual. You only knew your identity in relationship to the rest of your family. So who you are is related to who you belong to familiarly. And the point of those long genealogies in the scriptures is to say that when you know who you are in that broader setting, it locates you in your specific circumstance. Now, I'd suggest that that's one of the things that has sort of gone missing from our society. It went missing in Australian history very early on, because many of us were transported here from other places. And it's one of the reasons, I believe, that we see so many Australians going on a bit of a pilgrimage to Europe and the UK and trying to find out exactly where they came from, and getting some sense of a strong identity to stand in the village where their forefathers came from. And you'll hear Australian people say, I felt at home when I was there. But in the scriptures, the first thing is our identity is not just a self-related thing, but a familial-related thing. Who are we is related to whose are we in terms of the family structure. Second thing that you see it in the scriptures is that who are we is related to the national history of the people. So if you were to ask an Israelite, a faithful Israelite in the Old Testament, who they were, they would say, I am one of the sons of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. So it was not just that they knew themselves to be a Jewish person or an Israelite. They knew themselves to be one who inherited the covenant relationship that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and their forefathers had with God. So their national identity is likewise related to who they belong to. If you were to ask an Australian today, who does Australia belong to? The answer you'd get would be, well, nobody. It's ours. We're going to make it what we want to make it. We're going to shape this country to be what we want. There's a sense in which we're trying to find even our national identity, in some senses cut off from the sense of our belonging to God, certainly, and belonging to a covenant community that has a long history. And you get some illustrations of this concept of who we are being related to who we belong to, positively and negatively, in the scriptures. If you were to think of a psalm, like Psalm 100, if you've got a Bible, you might like to open to that and have a look. We'll be mainly in Genesis in a minute, but this is some introductory stuff. In Psalm 100, shout joyfully to the Lord, all the earth, serve the Lord with gladness, come before him with joyful singing. Know that the Lord himself is God. It is he who has made us, and not we ourselves. We are his people and the sheep of his pasture. Who are we as a group of Israelites? We are people who are the flock of God. So that means that God is our shepherd. That means that God is the one who leads us and guides us. He's the one who provides for us and sustains us. He's the one who spreads a table in the presence of our enemies. That gives you a rich sense of identity because you belong to God. So positively, the statement that I've made, who you are is related to whose you are. You see in those covenant psalms of Israel and other related passages. If you wanted a negative illustration of that, you could go to John chapter 8. And here Jesus is speaking to Jews who, in this instance, were not sort of faithful, believing members of that covenant community, but faithless members. And he says to them in verse 42, John 8 verse 42, Jesus said to them, "If God were your Father, you would love me, for I proceeded forth and have come from God, for I have not even come on my own initiative, but he sent me. Why do you not understand what I'm saying? It's because you cannot hear my word." And then he really spoils any chance he had of being received by them. "For you are of your father the devil, and you want to do the desires of your father." Now, Jesus, among other things, was not a very politically correct public speaker, was he? "You are of your father the devil. You want to do the desires of your father. He was a murderer from the beginning. He does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him." So who were these people? It's not simply that we can say, well, because by physical descent they were born of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, they are God's children. They, in fact, had rejected that status through their hardness of heart and unbelief. They manifested themselves not to be children of God, but children of the evil one. So Jesus is saying, my relationship to you is one on the basis of who you belong to. So what we're seeing just in that first and foremost is that when we talk about the questions of identity in the scriptures, you can't talk about it as an individualistic thing on the one hand, nor can you talk about it as a self-determining thing on the other hand. Identity relates to whose we are, familially, covenantally, and spiritually. Now, that forms a strong contrast with, I think, what we see in the world systems today and the way in which we think about our identity and the way in which people are trying to find their identity. And there's probably a number of ways you could think about this, but I'd just suggest a couple. Firstly, today we tend to get our sense of identity from our circumstances. Now, where we live says something about who we are. What sort of house we own in the place that we live in our society says something about who we are. What we drive, what we look like, what we wear, the circumstances of our family life and the success or otherwise of our children, if we have children. These are all things that we look for to get some sense of personal identity today. And we could say with all of them, they are circumstantial things. They don't relate to something that belongs to the realm of belonging. It relates to something that belongs to the world of possessing. Can you see the difference between that? In the scriptures, identity is really related to who owns us. And in the way we try and define our identity by our circumstances, more in the West now, we try and define ourselves by who or what we own. And the second thing that's related to that sense of circumstance by which we try to gain our sense of identity is our sense of abilities and achievements. Australia, much more than many other countries in the world, is what we could call a meritocracy. We really think well of people who work hard, who make a success of things, who start with nothing and work their way up to be a multi-billionaire, like the fellow who's just died in the last few weeks. And we think of these things highly in Australia because we think a person has forged for themselves by their own abilities and their native cunning and their sense of being able to take control of their destiny. They forged for themselves an identity and a set of achievements. So often in Australia, also in other parts of the Western world, but very commonly in Australia, the second question after "Hello, what's your name?" is "What do you do?" Because your ability to achieve and to achieve in the eyes of the world sets you apart and it gives you a sense of identity. And that identity is held over and against others. So what we find, because our identity starts to become linked with things like circumstances and abilities and therefore achievements, the things that we look to find our identity become competition markers within our society and relationships. And our identity then is evaluated on a horizontal level of relationships. And then we start to think about ourselves as we may appear in the eyes of other people. And so we start to evaluate our sense of identity on the basis of what other people might be thinking about us. And if we feel that other people are not thinking very well of us, then we'll throw ourselves back into the sort of circumstantial improvement cycle or the meritocracy achievement cycle to try and stabilise a sense of identity which has gone wobbly because compared to other people, our identity doesn't seem to be very well, very strong and defined. Does all of that make sense? Now, everything I'm saying today, I'm very aware that I'm a man speaking to a group of women. I'm not going to try and put myself in your shoes, but I am, as a human being, saying things that are common to human beings. So they apply to me and they apply to you. So that keeps us all happy. And it stops me from thinking that you don't think well of me because I... hi, come in. There's one down here or one down here. The other thing that we find, I think, in our society is because identity is becoming more and more linked with the circumstantial type things or the achievement orientation of our society, we find people getting disillusioned with where they've ended up. Men and women have sought to carve out for themselves an identity related to those circumstantial achievement type areas, and they've got there and they've found, well, actually this is not quite really where I want to be, and it's starting to drain on their mental, emotional, physical energies. It's starting to cost them a lot in terms of their relational life. And so what we find more today is that people then reinvent their identities, not in the criminal sense, but in the sense that you see in a lot of magazines and newspapers and programs on the TV, where you have an identity makeover, a lifestyle makeover. And you adopt a new image for a new phase of your life. And in all of that, you start then to wonder, who am I really? And I think what we're seeing in Australian society is a lot of folk who are not sure who they are really. They don't know who they belong to. They don't know their shepherd, so they're trying to find pastures for themselves and so forth. And so out of that, there's a sense in which people are on a bit of a pilgrimage to find themselves. You might put it as a search for meaning. I'm trying to find myself. And a lot of that's leading us into directions where Australian society is becoming more and more Eastern in its philosophical and religious systems. I'm one of the baby boomer generation, and baby boomers by and large have rejected the church and the gospel in droves. And if I had to take a guess, the most common worldview amongst baby boomers, whether they recognise it or not, would probably be Buddhist in terms of their worldview of what the creation's about, what life after death means, how you find meaning in the world. Now, if you listen to all of that, one of the things, therefore, that you will have probably heard or probably already started making the connection with is, therefore, what are the various roles that we have to fulfil during our life? It is a curious thing, isn't it, when you think about it, that we come out of our mother's womb and you're given a name, and for the most part, that identity is persistent all the way through. You know, you see a photo of Grandpa when he's 65 and you see a photo of Grandpa when he's 2 and you think, yeah, I can see that's the same person. How that happens is quite remarkable. But throughout the course of a life, there are numerous role changes that we have. It's one thing to be a son or a daughter at home. It's another thing to be a son and a daughter while you're away from home studying. It's another thing to be a son and a daughter if there are folk who are married, to be a son or a daughter in relationship to parents-in-law. And then for many folk, there is the question of what it means to be a mother or a father. Along with that, there are many, many role changes within our working lives, so that now you should expect, coming out of school, that you will probably have to go through at least 3 or 4 careers in your life. No longer is it the case that you start out doing one thing and you stay doing that thing until you retire. And then even when you retire, there are all these sort of changes that happen, different roles that you have to adopt. And you'll often hear people saying when they retire, I'm busier now than when I was working, and everyone wants me to do things. And then you hear of the people called the grey nomads, who spend their lives 6 months up in the northern tropics in caravans and then 6 months down here in our summer. And now, one of the things that I think we find, because our sense of identity has shifted into those circumstantial and achievement things, as we move between roles, as we move between the demands that all of those roles place on us, we start to get sort of dissipated in our own sense of who we are as a person, and we find all these competing agendas coming in upon us, and we don't know which ones to meet first or how to meet them. And we find ourselves the subject or the object of all sorts of expectations, and which ones should we fulfil and which ones shouldn't we fulfil. And we find ourselves very often in a place of deep confusion about our identities because of the various roles that we have to fulfil. Now, what I hope to say today, I hope what we say today will help us see that no matter what the role that we have to fulfil during our changing lifetime, nor what the circumstances are, nor the achievements that we do or do not reach, or the other things that come to us most unexpectedly, the joys and sorrows of life, nor our professional life, none of those finally are the ground of our true identity. But our identity in creation and vocation is something that goes all the way through from not just even birth to death, but from birth all the way through into eternity. And therefore it's not going to be tossed up and down by the various roles that you have to fulfill or the various changes of circumstances that take place during the course of a life. So that's hopefully what we'll be doing today. So firstly, identity in creation, and here we can go just back to Genesis chapter 1, and it says in 1 verse 26, God said, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them rule over the fish of the sea," and so forth. God created man his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. Now, the very, very, very first thing, I can't get more first than the first, but why do we say very first? But the very first thing is this, that we have been created. It's a very obvious statement. But if we have been created, that means a lot. It means, first of all, that a human being, male or female, no matter what stage of life you are, whether you're a 2-year-old or a 70-year-old, a male, female human being of any age has to receive everything from God. But the very fact that you're created means that you can't do anything for yourself. I saw a sticker the other day on a car. It said, "Your next breath is God's gift." I thought that's actually true. Your next heartbeat is God's gift. We can't do anything to sustain ourselves in this life at a very basic level. We just have to receive. And if you say to me, "Oh, but God gives us hands and he gives us abilities and he gives us jobs to do," all of that is true, but he gives you hands and he gives you job and he gives you soil to till and he gives you vegetables to grow and he gives you books to study so that you can become a physiotherapist or whatever. It's all given, can you see? So the first and foremost thing that we as a human being, we as human beings are in relationship to God, we are ones who receive from him. Definition of a human being is one who receives from God. And if we were to look at Jesus, the incarnate Son, a true man, his whole life was just receiving from God. "Father, what do you have for me today? I don't do anything of my own initiative. I just receive from you all the things that I have." Now, that does that mean that he wasn't busy? Did he sit quietly under the tree meditating? No, he was full, because God never stops giving, you see. So everything that we have, circumstantially, in terms of our gifts and abilities, in terms even of our basic functions of breathing, everything comes to us gift-wise from God. That's the first thing that belongs to being created. The second thing, therefore, that belongs to being created is, as a person who receives everything from God, that means we are to recognize we are dependent upon him. Australia is an interesting place because it doesn't use the word thankfulness in our public discussions. Whenever we have a great national event or a great national crisis, we don't have a Thanksgiving Day or a prayer day so much as a celebration or a strategy type day. Celebration is a sort of flat word. Thanks is a word that puts you in relationship to someone. Now, when you have a relationship with God creationally, where everything is received, the response to that from a true created human being's point of view, is joyful, thankful dependence. That's called faith. So every day Jesus opened his eyes, "Thank you, Father, for this day." And even when things went a little bit wrong, as we might put it, in terms of his ministry, one particular place, remember they refused to receive him, he said, "Thank you, Father, that you've allowed this to happen, that you've hidden this, hidden these things from the wise and the intelligent, revealed them to babes." So the first place we stand as a created human being is a place where we just receive from God all the time. And the second place, but all at the same time, we are reflexively, responsively, thankful, joyful receivers. So we express that in our praise, and that is faith. That's what faith is. It receives thankfully. So if our identity is going to be consistent throughout, then we need to know who we receive things from and who we give thanks to. And part of the confusion of the identity thing that we were talking about just a few minutes ago is we don't know who we're receiving them from, so we don't know to who we're thankful, and most times we think we're receiving them from ourselves, our abilities and our achievements, and so we give thanks to ourselves. Second thing is that you read in Genesis 1 verse 26, "Let us make man in our image." So the first thing is we're created. Second thing is that we're created in his image. And that's been subject to a lot of discussion, but I think there are many things that we can say. But two things stand out. One is the phrase "image" is linked with "therefore let him have dominion." So what does a two-year-old do as soon as he or she can learn to stack boxes? You start stacking boxes because you start to control your environment. And among other things, who does a two-year-old seek to control most? Us. Two-year-olds throw the most incredible tantrums, don't they? But he's trying, or she's trying, to exercise dominion. You've just got to do it. You cannot not do it. You have to. If you sit in your lounge room and you decide that you're not going out into the garden to do gardening, that's a dominion decision. You've decided an area that you're not going to exit, but it's something that you decide. Even in situations where we may not be able to do as much as we would like, even over the areas that we have, it's just built into us to exercise some control. And then we have people talking today about having control issues and things getting out of control and so forth. The second thing, and the thing that I want to spend a little bit more time on, created him in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. So there's a connection between being in the image and being created in maleness and femaleness. And I think probably the easiest and best way for us to understand that today is to put it this way. You have been created to relate. But you've been created to relate to someone who's the same as you but different from you. Now, if you think about the Christian doctrine of the Trinity, we say God the Father is the Father, and God the Son is the Son, and God the Holy Spirit is the Holy Spirit. But it is God the Father, and God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit. So one of the old formulas was it's three persons, but one substance. Now, we've got two persons, in a sense, and one substance. If you look at the song of Adam in chapter 2, verse 23, The man said, "Now this is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh." It's possible to translate this "at last." Because remember, God had brought the animals and none of them quite matched. Now, interestingly enough, did you see the advertisement for a program on, is it SBS, or I think it's SBS, a documentary coming up soon, where it says, "And man created animals." And the point of the program is that dogs and cats and horses and cows and all the domesticated animals didn't exist in the wild in that form. We've had to do something to get them like that. And today you've got strange animals like labradoodles. But the point is, we're exercising a dominion and we're bringing something useful out of that animal world and modifying it and shaping it. Amazing thing, really, that you should have a cow that gives milk or a dog that follows you. If you've got a dog that follows you, that's really something, isn't it? Most dogs don't. But he's had all these animals and nothing matches. And now he says, "At last, another one of me. Bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, but she's not man." Now this is a long way of saying it's one substance, but two persons. Like you and I, as a group of women and a man in your midst, we share a common humanity. We have one substance. But is there a difference between being a man and being a woman? Yes? Yes. Please say yes. Otherwise I'll have a terrible confusion of my identity. Maleness is maleness, isn't it? And femaleness is femaleness. And there are things given creationally for a female to do that a male cannot do. I cannot bear children. Someone said, "What's the difference between a male and a woman?" And the scientist scratched his head. I said, "I just can't conceive of any." Sorry, they're bad jokes today, aren't they? But we recognise there is one substance. That's how a man and a woman in marriage can be one flesh, because they have a one substance foundation for that one flesh relationship. Now, that means, therefore, that you as a woman and I as a man have to relate to someone who is the same but different. And here I have to tread really carefully. But have you ever tried getting into the head of a man? It is just such a strange world, isn't it? And what is the appeal of sheds, and why do men have them, and other things? And have men ever tried to get into the head of a woman? And it's a deep, mysterious thing, isn't it? That we should be so different in so many ways, and you're sort of forced to come out of yourself for that relationship, aren't you? You're forced not to stay within your own little area. You're actually forced to be in relationship to someone who's the same but different. Now, we could say, you know, that would be so for any two people. You know, any two women talking, any two men talking. That's true. But there is this bigger division. It's not just that there is a person who has gifts and abilities that God has given, and there's another person that God has given gifts and abilities to. There's a man and a woman. And there's a sense in which you come out to meet, and it's in that being centered on another other than yourself, that's where the image of God comes to the fore. The way in which the Father, so to speak, keeps going out of himself to the Son. And the Son keeps going out of himself to honour the Father, and the Spirit keeps going out of himself to glorify the Father and the Son. Now, creationally, that persists from wherever. Even though we were talking about two-year-olds before and the sort of temper tantrums, and I think a lot of those sort of things we have to put down to the doctrine of sin. It's one of the few doctrines in the Bible for which there is copious empirical evidence. But even then, you see, children want to go out of themselves to relate. And they want to be the object of love and affection. We're actually created for that. So that persists. Now, no matter where you are in life, whether you're a two-year-old or a 70-year-old, you're going to be in that situation where somewhere, somehow, you are drawn out to another, where it's not just all receiving. So your identity is known in the way you give and receive, in the way you honour and give thanks in that relational context. Does that make sense? So we've been created, so there's this sense of dependence, this recognition that everything comes from God, this joyful thanksgiving that it is this way, that we don't have to be self-made people because we can look to God as our shepherd. And that we've been created in his image. There's a sense in which we look and need to exercise that rulership and dominion in whatever area of life. And then in that we have this relational union. The third thing, and there's others we could, but the third that I want to concentrate on is that if you run your eye down to the beginning of chapter 2 in Genesis, thus the heavens and the earth were completed and all their hosts. By the seventh day God completed his work which he had done. Verse 3, God blessed the seventh day, sanctified it because he rested. Now, if you look at the account of the Ten Commandments in the book of Exodus, the origin of a Sabbath rest comes back to creation. Now, one of the things that this passage tells us is that the goal of creation, on the sixth day he made male and female, man and woman, created in his own image, the pinnacle of that whole process of creation. But the goal of that creation is that the man and the woman might be in God's rest. And one of the things that you notice about that seventh day, this rest period in chapter 2, all the other days have, there was evening and morning, there was morning and evening. But that's not hedged by any parameter. The point is that we have been created for eternity, for an eternity of rest. Now, when I use the word rest, don't think sleep, even though when you've got lots of little kids running around and you're sleep deprived, it would be heaven, wouldn't it? But rest in the Bible is related to the concepts of fullness, fruitfulness, blessing, peace, not just absence of strife, but peace in the full Hebrew sense of richness of life and richness of relationships. We've actually been created for rest, that rest of God. That place where you can live and work, because the man and the woman were to till the garden and to keep it and to watch over it and so forth. But you can work from a position of rest. You can be at peace. You can be full in your heart and your spirit. You can be overflowing in the blessings of God, and you can be busy, but you're not frantic. But one thing that makes you frantic is when the things that you're trying to do are the things that you're trying to secure identity with. So when we're created in God's image, the goal of that is restfulness. That's what we've been created for. And remember, Jesus said, come to me, all those who labour and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. No one else could do that. People looked for someone to give them rest all the way through their history. That's what Noah's name means, by the way. Lamech called his son Noah because he said, perhaps this one will give us rest or comfort from our labours. And none of the kings could bring them rest, and none of the so-called messiahs of Israel, who are actually false messiahs, could bring them rest. But Christ said, I can bring you to my resting place as the good shepherd. And you think, well, what does that have to do with my sense of identity? And I think two things. One is that where that rest is missing, we can almost certainly say that we are trying to find an identity out of activity instead. And the second thing is that where that rest is present, no matter what the circumstances or the change in roles or the professional vocations that we have, your identity is not linked with them. So that it's possible at one point, Paul says, I've learned to be content. So whether I have plenty, I can be content with that. Whether I have little, I can be content with that, because he knew he could be at rest wherever he was. So our identity is very much bound up with the state of rest in which our hearts and souls find themselves, and that state of rest comes to us through God's own gift and his own grace. Now, we are coming to an end of this first session, and we'll revive ourselves with a cuppa in a second. But what I need to finish on is this, for this session, that everything in there, whether we talk about being created and therefore a receiver from God's goodness, you know, man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God, and a joyful thanksgiver for God's gift. Whether we talk about the relational life that we have to express the image of God, whether we talk about the dominion we exercise, whether we talk about the rest that we've been created to receive, all of that marks the identity of a human being all the way through. None of that changes, no matter what the age or stage of life that I'm in, none of that changes, not one bit of it. Can a little child be at rest? Can a little child live by faith and trust in God to receive? Of course, Jesus said, unless you have faith like a little child. Is it possible for an elderly person to be in that state? So is it possible anywhere in the middle to be at that state? So your identity doesn't have to come from the other things we were talking about. Because if you think about those other things, the sort of circumstantial achievement-based identity type things that we look for, the appearance-based identity things, we're really there because we don't know the other. We're there because we don't know whose image we're created in, so we're trying to find an image that fits us. And we're really there because we don't know where we find our rest, and we're desperately looking for somewhere and hoping that we can get it. And we're there in all of that frantic action because in that place we feel that somehow our relational life will be okay. You know, if we have enough stuff and our identity is secure enough and we're attractive enough, and we find it's not. You would think if there was a direct relationship between finding our identity from what we possess and security in relationship, you'd think Australia would have to be the happiest, most relationally contented nation on earth. Because no other nation has it as good as Australia. Really, no other nation does. And I reckon we're worse. Probably about the most grumbly group of people you could meet as a nation. Just don't get me started about the weather or whatever else it is. So creationally, we have a sense of identity that is persistent and consistent and is received. Now, we know, of course, the account of how human sin has entered the world and has twisted and perverted all of that. But the twisting and perverting of it doesn't actually change the reality. That the reality of where our identity is just always there, whether sin has twisted it or perverted it or not. So what we're going to see in the second session is how this relates to vocation, and there in particular I'm talking about calling, and how therefore we can perhaps put together this sense of a creational consistent identity and a vocational identity which moves in and out of roles and circumstances throughout our life, but yet finally doesn't budge from who we are and where we are. Now, let's just stop there. There's so many things we could say.